Chapter 3. The consulting neurologist pinned up the x-rays again and searched for indentations that would look as if the skull had been pounded like copper with a tiny hammer. Dr. Klein stood behind him with folded arms. They had both looked for lesions and collections of fluid, for a possible shifting of the pineal gland. They were probing now for Leuchenschartel's skull, the telltale depressions that would indicate chronic intracranial pressure. They did not find it. The date was Thursday, April 28. The consulting neurologist removed his glasses and carefully tucked them into the left breast pocket of his jacket.
"Well, there's just nothing there, Sam. Nothing I can see."
Klein frowned at the floor and shook his head. "Doesn't figure," he said.
"You want to run another series?"
"No, I don't think so. I think I'll try an LP."
"Yeah, good idea.
In the meantime, I'd like you to see her."
"Okay. How's today?"
"Well, I'm..."
Sound of a telephone buzzer.
"Excuse me, Sam." Klein picked up the telephone.
"Yes?"
"Mrs. McNeil's on the phone. She says it's urgent."
"Okay, what line?" "She's on 3.
Klein punched the extension button.
"Dr. Klein here."
Chris's voice was distraught and on the brim of hysteria.
"Oh, Christ, Doc, it's Reagan. Can you come right away?"
"But what's wrong?"
"I don't know, Doc. I just can't describe it. Come over. Please come over right away. Come now."
"Okay, I'm on the way."
He disconnected and buzzed his receptionist. "Susan, tell Dresner to take my appointments." Klein hung up the phone and started taking off his jacket.
"That's her, Dick," he said.
"You want to come? It's only just across the bridge."
"Well, I've got an hour, I'd say."
"Okay, let's go." They were there within minutes, and at the door where a frightened-looking Sharon greeted them, they heard moans and screams of terror from Reagan's bedroom.
"I'm Sharon Spencer," she told them. "Come on in. She's upstairs."
Sharon led them to the door of Reagan's bedroom, then cracked it open slightly and called in,
"Chris, doctors!"
Chris instantly came to the door, her face contorted in a vice of fear.
"Oh, my God, come in," she said in a quavering voice. "Come on in and take a look at what she's doing."
"This is Dr.—"
In the middle of the introduction, Klein broke off as he caught sight of Reagan. Shrieking hysterically and flailing her arms, her body seemed to fling itself up horizontally into the air above her bed and then be slammed down savagely onto the mattress. It was happening rapidly, again and again.
"Oh, Mother, make him stop!"
Reagan was screeching.
"Stop him! He's trying to kill me! Stop him! Stop him, Mother!"
"Oh, my baby,"
Chris whimpered as she jerked up a fist to her mouth and bit it. She turned a beseeching look to Klein.
"For God's sake, what's happening, Doc? What is it?"
Klein shook his head, his gaze fixed on Reagan as the phenomenon continued. She would lift about a foot each time and then fall with a wrenching of her breath, as if unseen hands had picked her up and thrown her down. Chris pressed both her hands to her mouth, staring wildly as the up-and-down movements abruptly ceased, and Reagan started twisting feverishly from side to side, with her eyes rolled upward into their sockets so that only the whites were exposed.
"Oh, he's burning me! He's burning me!"
she was moaning, as her legs began rapidly crossing and uncrossing. The doctors moved closer, one on either side of the bed, and still twisting and jerking, Reagan arched her head back, disclosing a swollen, bulging throat, as she muttered incomprehensibly in a guttural tone,
No on my.
Klein reached down to check her pulse. "Now let's see what the trouble is, dear," he said gently. And abruptly he was reeling across the room, staggering backward from the force of a vicious swing of Reagan's arm, as she suddenly sat up, her face contorted with a hideous rage.
"The sow is mine!"
she bellowed in a coarse and powerful voice.
"She is mine! Keep away from her! She is mine!"
A yelping laugh gushed up from her throat,
and then she fell on her back as if someone had pushed her. She pulled up her nightgown, exposing her genitals.
Fuck me! Fuck me!
She screamed at the doctors, and with both her hands began masturbating frantically. Moments later, Chris ran from the room with a stifled sob, right after Reagan put her finger to her lips and licked them. Riveted, watching in shock, Klein approached the bedside again, this time warily, as Reagan appeared to hug herself, her arms folded, her hands caressing them.
Ah, yes, my pearl, she crooned in that strangely coarsened voice, and with both her eyes closed as if in ecstasy. My child, my flower, my pearl.
Then again she was twisting from side to side, moaning meaningless syllables over and over, until abruptly she sat up with her eyes staring wide in helpless terror. She mewed like a cat. Then she barked, then neighed like a horse, and then bending at the waist, started whirling her torso around in rapid, strenuous circles. She gasped for breath.
Oh, stop him, she wept. Please stop him, it hurts. Make him stop, I can't breathe.
Klein had seen enough. He fetched his medical bag to the window and quickly began to prepare an injection. The neurologist remained beside the bed and saw Reagan fall backward as if from a shove, while her eyes rolled upward into their sockets again. And with her body rolling from side to side, she began to mutter rapidly in guttural tones. The neurologist leaned closer and tried to make it out. Then he saw Klein beckoning, and he straightened up and went to him quickly.
I'm giving her Librium, Klein told him guardedly, holding the syringe to the light of the window. But you're going to have to hold her.
The neurologist nodded, yet he seemed preoccupied, inclining his head to the side, as if listening to the muttering from the bed.
What's she saying? Klein whispered. I don't know, just gibberish, nonsense syllables.
Yet his own explanation seemed to leave him unsatisfied.
She says it as if it means something, though. It's got cadence.
Klein nodded toward the bed, and the men approached quietly from either side. As they came, the tormented child went rigid, as if in the stiffening grip of tetany, and the doctors who had stopped at the bedside turned and looked at each other significantly. Then they looked again to Reagan as she started to arch her body upward into an impossible position, bending it backward like a bow until the brow of her head had touched her feet. She was screaming in pain. The doctors eyed one another with baffled and questioning surmise. And then Klein gave a signal to the neurologist. But before the consultant could seize her, Reagan fell limp in a faint and wet the bed. Klein leaned over and rolled up her eyelid. He checked her pulse.
Well, she'll be out for a while, he murmured.
I think she convulsed, don't you?
Yes, I think so.
Well, let's take some insurance. Klein deftly administered the injection.
Well, what do you think?
Klein asked as he pressed a circle of sterile tape against the puncture.
Temporal lobe? Sure, maybe schizophrenia is a possibility, Sam, but the onset's much too sudden. She hasn't any history of it, right?
No, she hasn't.
Neurasthenia? Klein shook his head. And hysteria, maybe?
Yeah, I've thought of that, said Klein.
Well, of course. Though she'd have to be a freak to get her body twisted up like she did voluntarily now, wouldn't you say?
The neurologist shook his head.
No, I think it's pathological, Sam. Her strength, the paranoia, the hallucinations. Schizophrenia, okay. Those symptoms it covers. But temporal lobe would also cover the convulsions. There's one thing that bothers me, though.
He trailed off with a puzzled frown.
What's that? Well, I'm really not sure, but I thought I heard signs of dissociation. You know, my pearl, my child, my flower, the sow. had a feeling she was talking about herself. Was that your impression, too, or am I reading something into it?
As he mulled the question, Klein stroked his lower lip with a finger, and then answered, "Well, frankly, at the time it never occurred to me, but now that you point it out..." He made a sound in his throat, looking thoughtful. "Yeah, could be," he said. "Yeah, I guess it could."
Then he shrugged off the notion. "Well, I'm going to do an LP right now while she's out, and then maybe we'll know something. Sound right?" The neurologist nodded.
Klein poked around in his medical bag, found a pill, and as he tucked it into a pocket, he asked the neurologist, "Can you stay?"
The neurologist checked his watch.
"Yeah, sure.
Let's talk to the mother." They left the room and entered the hallway. Their heads lowered, Chris and Sharon were leaning against the balustrade by the staircase. As the doctors approached them, Chris wiped at her nose with a moist and balled-up handkerchief. Her eyes were red and small from crying.
"She's sleeping," Klein told her, "and she's heavily sedated. She'll probably sleep right through until tomorrow."
Gently nodding, Chris responded weakly, "That's good.
Look, I'm sorry about being such a baby."
"You're doing just fine," Klein assured her. "It's a frightening ordeal. By the way, this is Dr. Richard Coleman."
Chris smiled at him bleakly. "Thanks for coming."
"Dr. Coleman's a neurologist."
"Oh, yeah? And so what do you think?" she asked as she shifted her glance from one of the men to the other.
"Well, we still think it's temporal lobe," Klein answered, and...
"Jesus, what in the hell are you talking about?" Chris suddenly erupted. "She's been acting like a psycho, like a split personality or something. I mean..."
"Then, oh," she uttered softly and in pain, as abruptly she pulled herself together and lowered her forehead into a hand. "Guess I'm all uptight," she said quietly as she lifted a haggard look to Klein. "I'm so sorry," she said. "You were saying..." It was the neurologist who answered. "Mrs. McNeil," he said gently, "there haven't been more than 100 authenticated cases of split personality in all of medical history. It's a very rare condition. Now, I know the temptation is to leap to psychiatry, but any responsible psychiatrist would exhaust the somatic possibilities first. That's the safest procedure."
"Well, okay then. So, what's next?"
"A lumbar tap," said Coleman.
"You mean a spinal?" Chris asked him with a look of distress.
He nodded. "What we missed in the x-rays and the EEG could turn up there. At the least, it would exhaust certain other possibilities. I'd like to do it now, right here, while she's sleeping. I'll give her a local, of course, but it's movement I'm trying to eliminate."
"Listen, how could she jump off the bed like that?" Chris asked, her eyes squinting in incomprehension.
"Well, I think we've discussed that before, Mrs. McNeil," said Klein. "Pathological states can induce abnormal strength and accelerated motor performance."
"But you said you don't know why."
"Well, it seems to have something to do with motivation," Coleman answered. "But it's about all we know."
"Well, now what about the spinal?" Klein asked Chris. "Can we go ahead with this?"
Abruptly sagging, Chris stared at the floor. "Go ahead," she said softly.
"Do whatever you have to. Just make her well."
"May I use your phone?" asked Klein.
"Yeah, sure. Come on. There's one in the study."
"Oh, incidentally," said Klein, as Chris turned around to lead them, "she needs to have her bedding changed." Quickly moving away, Sharon briskly said, "I'll do it right now."
"Can I make you some coffee?" asked Chris as the doctors followed her down the stairs. "I gave the housekeeping couple the afternoon off, so it'll have to be instant."
They declined.
"I see you haven't fixed that window yet," noted Klein. "No, we called, though," Chris told them. They're coming out tomorrow with shutters you can lock."
They entered the study where Klein called his office,
and instructed an assistant to deliver the necessary equipment and medication to the house. "And set up the lab for a spinal workup," he instructed. "I'll run it myself right after the tap." When he'd finished the call, Klein asked Chris what had happened since last he saw Reagan. "Well, let's see now. Last Tuesday," Chris pondered. No, on Tuesday there was nothing at all. She went straight up to bed and slept right through until late the next morning and... "Oh, no, wait," she amended. No, she didn't, that's right. Willie mentioned that she'd heard her in the kitchen awfully early. I remember feeling glad that she'd gotten her appetite back, but she went back to bed then, I guess, because she stayed there the rest of the day. "She was sleeping?" Klein asked her. No, I think she was reading. Well, I started feeling a little better about it all. I mean, it looked as if the Librium was just what she needed. She seemed sort of, far away, and that bothered me a little. But still, it was a pretty big improvement. Then last night again? Nothing, Chris continued. Then this morning it started. Boy, did it start. She'd been sitting in the kitchen, Chris recounted, when Reagan ran screaming down the stairs to her, cowering defensively behind her chair as she clutched Chris's arm and told her in a high-pitched, frightened voice that Captain Howdy was chasing her. He had been pinching her, punching her, shoving her, mouthing obscenities, threatening to kill her. "There he is!" she had shrieked at last while pointing to the kitchen door. Then she'd fallen to the floor, her body jerking in spasms, as she gasped and wept and said that Howdy was kicking her. Then suddenly, Chris told the doctors, Reagan had stood in the middle of the kitchen with her arms extended and had begun to spin rapidly around like a top, continuing the movements for almost a minute until she had fallen to the floor in exhaustion. "And then all of a sudden," Chris finished distressfully, "I saw there was this hate in her eyes, this hate, and she told me, she called me a..." "Oh, Jesus." Chris burst into convulsive sobbing. Klein moved to the bar, poured a glass of water from the tap, and walked back toward Chris. The sobbing had ceased. "Oh, shit, where's a cigarette?" she sighed tremulously, wiping at her eyes with the knuckle of a finger. Klein gave her the water and a small green pill. "Try this instead," he advised. "That a tranquilizer?" "Yes, I'll have a double. One's enough." Chris looked away and smiled wanly. "Big spender." Chris swallowed the pill and then handed the empty glass to the doctor. "Thanks," she said softly, and then rested her brow on quivering fingertips and gently shook her head. "Yeah, that's when it started," she picked up moodily. "All of that other stuff was like she was someone else." "Like Captain Howdy, perhaps?" asked Coleman. Chris looked up at him in puzzlement. He was staring so intently. "What do you mean?" she asked. He shrugged. "I don't know. Just a question." Chris turned absent eyes to the fireplace. "I don't know," she said dully. "Just somebody. Somebody else." There was a moment of silence. Then Coleman stood up. He had another appointment, he told them, and after some vaguely reassuring statement, he said goodbye. Klein walked him to the door. "You'll check the sugar?" Coleman asked him. "No, I'm the Rosalind Village idiot," said Klein. Coleman smiled thinly. "I'm a little uptight about this myself," he said. He looked away pensively, stroking his lips and his chin with thumb and fingers. "A strange case," he brooded quietly. "Very strange." He turned back to Klein. "Let me know what you find out." "You'll be home?" Yes, I will. Give a call, okay?" "Okay." Coleman waved and left. When the equipment arrived a short time later, Klein anesthetized Reagan's spinal area with Novocaine, and as Chris and Sharon watched, he extracted the spinal fluid,
while keeping a careful eye on the manometer. "Pressure's normal," he murmured. When he'd finished, he went to the window's light to see if the fluid was clear or hazy. It was clear. Klein stowed the tubes of fluid in his bag. "I doubt that she will," he said, "but in case she awakens in the middle of the night and creates a disturbance, you might want a nurse here to give her sedation."
"Oh, can't I do it myself?" Chris asked.
"Well, why not a nurse?" Chris shrugged. She did not want to mention her distrust of doctors and nurses.
I'd just rather do it myself," she said simply.
"Well, injections are tricky," Klein cautioned. "An air bubble can be very dangerous."
"Oh, I know how to do it," Sharon interjected. "My mother ran a nursing home up in Oregon." "Oh, would you do that, Cher?" Chris asked her. "Would you stay here tonight?"
"Well, beyond tonight," Klein put in. "She may need intravenous feeding, depending on how she comes along."
"Could you teach me how to do it, Doc?" Chris asked him. She was staring at him anxiously. I need to do it."
Klein nodded and said, "Sure. Sure? Guess I could." He wrote a prescription for soluble Thorazine and disposable syringes and gave it to Chris. "Have this filled right away," he told her. Chris handed it to Sharon. "Cher, take care of that for me, would you? Just call it, they'll send it."
"I'd like to go with the doctor while he makes those tests."
Chris turned and looked up at the doctor wistfully.
"Do you mind?"
Klein noted the tightness around her eyes, the look of helplessness, of confusion. He said, "Sure. Sure, I know how you feel. Feel the same way when I talk to mechanics about my car." Chris stared at him, wordlessly. They left the house at precisely 6:18 p.m. In his laboratory in the Roslyn Medical Building, Klein ran a number of tests. First, he analyzed protein content. Normal. Then a count of blood cells. "Too many red," Klein explained, "means bleeding, and too many white would mean infection." He was looking in particular for a fungus infection that was often the cause of chronic, bizarre behavior. And again, drew a blank. At the last, Klein tested the fluid sugar content.
"Oh, how come that?" Chris asked.
"Well," he told her, "the spinal sugar should measure 2/3 of the amount of blood sugar, and anything significantly under that ratio would mean a disease in which the bacteria eat the sugar in the spinal fluid. And if so, it could account for your daughter's symptoms." But he failed to find it. Chris folded her arms and shook her head. "Here we are again, folks," she murmured bleakly. For a while, Klein brooded. Then at last he turned and looked to Chris.
Do you keep any drugs in your house?" he asked her.
"Huh? Amphetamines, LSD? Chris shook her head and said, "No. Look, I tell you, no, there's nothing like that."
Klein nodded, looked down at his shoes, then somberly looked back up at Chris as he told her,
"I guess it's time we started looking for a psychiatrist."
Chris was back in the house at exactly 7:21 p.m., and at the door she called out, "Sharon?" No answer. Sharon wasn't there. Chris went upstairs to Reagan's bedroom and found her still heavily asleep, without even a ruffle in her covers.
There was an odor of urine in the room, Chris noticed. She looked from the bed to the window. Jesus, wide open! She thought Sharon must have opened it to air out the room. But where was she now? Where did she go?
Chris walked over to the window, pulled it down shut and locked it, then went back downstairs just as Willie came through the front door.
"Oh, hiya, Willie. Any fun today?"
"Shopping, Mrs. Movies."
"Where's Carl, Willie?"
Willie made a gesture of dismissal. "He lets me see Beatles movie this time, by myself."
"Good work, Willie."
"Yes, madam."
Willie held up two fingers in a V for victory sign.
The time was 7:35 p.m. At 8:01, while Chris was in the study on the phone with her agent, she heard the front door coming open and closed again, high-heeled footsteps approaching, then saw Sharon entering the study with several packages in her arms, which she'd set on the floor. Sharon then flopped down into an overstuffed chair and waited while Chris continued talking. "Where have you been?" asked Chris when she'd finished. "Oh, didn't he tell you?"
"Oh, didn't who tell me?"
"Burke. Isn't he here?"
"He was here?"
"You mean he wasn't when you got home?"
"Listen, start all over," said Chris.
"Oh, that nut," Sharon chided with a head shake. "I couldn't get the druggist to deliver, so when Burke came around, I thought, fine, he can stay here with Reagan while I go get the Thorazine."
Sharon shook her head again.
"Yeah, I should have known."
"Yeah, you should have.
So what did you buy?" "Well, since I thought I had time, I went and I bought a rubber draw sheet for Reagan's bed."
"Did you eat, Sharon?"
"No, I thought I'd fix a sandwich. Would you like one?"
"Yeah, good idea."
"So what happened with the tests?" Sharon asked as they walked to the kitchen.
"All negative," Chris answered her damply. "I'm going to have to get a shrink."
After sandwiches and coffee, Sharon showed Chris how to give an injection. "The two main things," she explained, "are to make sure that there aren't any air bubbles, and then you make sure you haven't hit a vein. See, you aspirate a little, huh, like this?" She was demonstrating. "And you see if there's blood in the syringe." For a time, Chris practiced the procedure on a grapefruit and seemed to grow proficient. Then, at 9:28, the front doorbell rang. Willie answered. It was Carl. As he passed through the kitchen en route to his room, he nodded a good evening and remarked that he'd forgotten to take his key. "I can't believe it," Chris said to Sharon. "That's the first time he's ever admitted a mistake." They passed the evening watching television in the study. At 11:46, Sharon answered the phone, said, "Hold on," and then passed the receiver to Chris, saying, "It's Chuck, Chris, the young director of the second unit." He sounded grave. "Have you heard the news yet, Chris?"
"News? No. What?"
"Well, it's bad."
"Bad?"
"Burke's dead. He'd been drunk. He had stumbled. He had fallen down the steep flight of steps beside the house to the bottom, where a passing pedestrian on M Street watched as he tumbled into night without end. A broken neck, this bloody, crumpled scene, his last." As the telephone fell from Chris's fingers, she was silently weeping, and then stood up unsteadily. Sharon ran to her and caught her, steadied her, hung up the phone, and then led her to the sofa.
"Chris, what is it? What's wrong?"
Burke's dead."
"Oh, my God, Chris. No. What happened?"
But Chris shook her head. She couldn't speak. She wept. Then later they talked. For hours. Chris drank, reminisced about Dennings, now laughed, now cried.
"Oh, my God," she kept sighing. "Poor crazy old Burke. Poor Burke."
Her dream of death kept coming back to her. At a little past 5 in the morning, Chris was standing moodily behind the bar, her elbows propped, her head lowered, and her eyes very sad, as she waited for Sharon to return from the kitchen with a tray of ice. Then at last she heard her coming.
"I still can't believe it," said Sharon, as she entered the study.
Chris looked up, then to the side, and froze, gliding spider-like rapidly close behind Sharon. Her body arched backward in a bow with her head almost touching her feet was Reagan, her tongue flicking quickly in and out of her mouth while she sibilantly hissed and moved her head very slightly, back and forth like a cobra. Staring numbly, Chris said,
Sharon?
Sharon stopped. So did Reagan. Sharon turned and saw nothing, and then screamed and jumped away as she felt Reagan's tongue snaking out at her ankle. Chris threw a hand to her cheek, her face ashen. Call that doctor and get him out of bed. Get him now. Whenever Sharon moved, Reagan would follow.